These days, satellite technology is used to deliver everything, from weather reports to news reports. We use satellites to make long-distance phone calls and send faxes, not to mention broadcast radio programs. But veteran broadcaster Robert Trout remembers a world without satellites, and the day, 35 years ago this afternoon, when Telstar, the world's first communication satellite, went to work.
When CBS sent me to London in the early years of World War II, my broadcasts often seemed at the mercy of atmospheric gremlins. This was because the only radio link between the continents was shortwave, a maddening technology whose wayward ways regularly sent listeners scrambling for the nearest newspaper. At the height of the war, they might hear something like this.
This is Robert Trout in London. The supreme crisis has now begun. A few minutes ago, in a sudden move, Mr. Churchill immediately reacted by ordering all available forces tuned for further details.
35 years ago today, all that changed.
I understand now that the French antenna is starting to track the satellite, and it should not be very long before they are in complete auto track.
On July 10th, 1962, a NASA rocket had lifted the world's first communication satellite into orbit. AT&T called it Telstar. After a trial run the next day, the three American networks and Eurovision pooled their resources for a formal transatlantic inaugural broadcast. On a hot July Monday afternoon, exactly 35 years ago, the world suddenly grew smaller.
I have just received word that the French are ready and the program can now start.
On Telstar's 124th orbit, monitors in Europe flickered for a second, rolled over, then snapped into focus. My CBS colleague, Walter Cronkite, who had been evening news anchor for all of 13 weeks at that point, began to speak.
Eurovision, we're now putting up our Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor on the left side of our monitor. If you'll please put up your Eiffel Tower in Paris next to it. We're going to wait for your signal. If that's been completed, we'll go on that signal.
As the BBC's Richard Dimbleby answered Cronkite, it was as if the hand of science reached out and parted the waters of the Atlantic.
Hello, Walter Cronkite. Hello, United States. On my television screen here in Brussels, I have on the left-hand side the Statue of Liberty, on the right-hand side the Eiffel Tower. They are both together, it's clear. So go, America, go. Go, America, go.
Transfixed viewers leaned forward in a primal wonder and astonishment. The first formal transmissions, critic Gilbert Seldes would write, were almost unbearably exciting.
Good evening, Europe. This is the North American continent live via AT&T Telstar, July 23rd, 1962, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the east. The New York skyline on the Atlantic Ocean. On the west, 3,000 miles away, San Francisco. Between these two oceans, 180 million Americans have begun another week. These first 18 minutes will attempt to show you a few of the things that are going on right now on the North American continent.
Europe would see a scrapbook of Americana, narrated by Chet Huntley of NBC and Howard K. Smith of ABC. The program was to begin with President Kennedy's weekly news conference. But when Andover began getting Telstar signals early, Europe's first look at America turned out to be the Cubs and the Phillies in Wrigley Field, Chicago.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just been informed that this baseball game is being seen in Europe right now over the Telstar satellite.
David Buxbaum was an associate producer of the first telecast.
That was an afterthought, and it was put in the night before the broadcast. And we quick looked in the newspaper and said the only game tomorrow is in Chicago. And I remember it was a Sunday night. We called a man named Jack Brickhouse, who was the broadcaster, the sports director of WGN, I think, in Chicago. And we told him what we wanted to do, and he said, I'll take care of it. Brickhouse started broadcasting free tickets to the Cubs game, and he filled up the stadium.
Here it is, a brief glimpse of American baseball played in the biggest arena in the world, all the way from Wrigley Field in Chicago to the Coliseum in Rome. And there's Johnny Callison with a good hard smash to right field.
From Chicago, the program went to Washington, where President Kennedy's weekly news conference was by now in progress. In the summer of 1962, speculation in gold was causing wild price fluctuations in European markets. When a reporter asked if the dollar would remain at $35 an ounce, Kennedy told the continent what it wanted to hear.
If we devalued, all other currencies would devalue, and so that those who speculate against the dollar are going to lose. The United States will not devalue its dollar.
With the speed of light, Kennedy's words stabilized the gold market, and Telstar demonstrated not just a new technology, but the power of its influence. Finally, after music by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and a pause at the United Nations, Telstar sank below the horizon. At 6 that evening, on the 125th orbit, Europe got its chance, and the excitement began again. Howard K. Smith.
Now we're waiting for a signal from Brussels via Goonhilly Downs.
The program is ready to start, Mr.
Hello, America. Are you receiving our pictures from Europe, please?
We now have Big Ben on our monitors here, Mr. Dimbleby. So go, Europe, go.
Hello, North America. July the 23rd, 1962. Little less than 2 minutes to 11.
Because Telstar circled the Earth in a low orbit, it covered the Atlantic for only 18 minutes at a time. When it dipped under the horizon, transmission didn't end gracefully. The link just snapped.
And by me here, the ancient Tower of London, where now we witness a ritual.
In 1965, NASA would launch Early Bird in a synchronous orbit. By matching the rotation of the Earth, the Bird, as we called it, became a continuous link over the Atlantic. In a few years, Peter Jennings and I would broadcast live by way of satellite from the Vatican on the election of a pope. But in Youngstown, Albuquerque, and Spokane, we would sound no farther away than the local weatherman. On this day 35 years ago, such things seemed a miracle. Today, when we see Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw in Hong Kong or Berlin, we no longer marvel at the technology. We listen to what they're saying. For a reporter, that's the way it's supposed to be. For National Public Radio, this is Robert Trout, 22,000 miles out in space by way of Galaxy 4.